Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening and Happy New Year. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Happy New Year to you too, Tom, and to everybody out there across the state. Let's begin by taking a look back. 2020. Man, what a year. Of course, it was dominated by the pandemic and politics, and often the two were really intertwined here in Florida. Let's take a look back now to earlier in the year. Public schools closed in mid-March, and by April, the state had issued a month-long stay-at-home order. Restaurants, bars, hotels, other businesses, they all essentially closed down in the effort to slow the spread of COVID-19. Unemployment shot way up, and the state's online unemployment system crashed, leaving tens of thousands out of work for weeks on end with no income.
Governor Ron DeSantis would later declare that closing schools in the springtime was one of the biggest public health mistakes in modern American history. He also then went on to ban local governments from closing businesses again, even as COVID infections surged. Now, Florida generally followed the Trump administration's lead, resisting calls for a statewide mask mandate, for instance, even prohibiting counties and cities from collecting fines from people breaking local mask rules.
That's right. Now, the pandemic pushed millions of you out there to vote by mail, despite President Trump's unfounded efforts to undermine that process. For once, Florida ran a very smooth election, and it delivered Florida again to President Trump and helped ring up more victories for Republicans here. So for the full hour on the Roundup, we're going to take a look back at 2020, the extraordinary year that was. And then later in the show, we'll look ahead to what we can expect in the Sunshine State for 2021. Two great guests are joining us today for the full hour as we welcome Ana Ceballos. She covers state government and politics for the Miami Herald. Ana, good to have you on the show.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
Happy New Year to you as well. Also joining us, A.G. Gankarski, reporter with Florida Politics. Hey, A.G., Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year and great to be here.
Great to have you both for the hour. Ana, let's begin with you. Obviously, the pandemic is the story of the year. How do you see it influencing the election here in Florida? What impact do you think it played here this year?
Well, this year, I mean, it was quite amazing what we saw in terms of Trump's victory in Florida. You know, we saw him win 4 years, well, in 2016 by 1.2% of a margin, and he nearly tripled that margin in Florida by, you know, making gains in Miami-Dade by just an amazing amount. And then making also gains in about 50 of the 67 Florida counties where, you know, there were, it went from the wooing Hispanic voters in Osceola County, where there's a lot of Puerto Ricans, to Cuban Americans in Miami-Dade County. And a lot of it had to do with just messaging. And the pandemic was a big part of the overall policies that Democrats and Republicans battled with in terms of unemployment, how to fix the unemployment system here in Florida. So what we saw here really was whether or not it was a referendum on like the response to the pandemic. We saw that a lot of the Hispanic voters who voted for Trump, the message that really resonated with them was the message of socialism. It was more of the economic aspect of what the election meant for them. For some Democrats, they were saying that it was more of the overall response to contain the virus in Florida. But in the end, we saw an election that went pretty decisively for Trump here in Florida. And we saw gains throughout the state, not just in certain counties.
AG, how about the election influencing the pandemic response here in Florida? Because we had that confluence in the springtime as the pandemic took hold, the stay-at-home orders came into place, and then the calls from the Oval Office and then the governor's mansion about reopening the economy happening just at the same time that, you know, the election campaigning was beginning to hit a fever pitch.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Tom, because You know, this governor politicized pandemic response in a way that perhaps no other governor in the country. We saw it with the stand-up with Mike Pence during the summer, saying that the curve had been flattened, and it's, you know, 8 weeks after they said it was going to be like New York and Italy, and then the summer surge that happened that the governor called the Sunbelt surge, using the White House's nomenclature for it. You know, we have a big state with a lot of crowded areas, but Governor DeSantis' policy was basically something like Kristi Noem in South Dakota. Very minimal government interference, no mask, et cetera. And it was marketed under the aegis of freedom. Basically, this is liberty. You know, but the governor's office says that, you know, as long as hospitalizations are not past a certain point, as long as the system holds, then they are succeeding. And they say that their response has been tailored toward, you know, people most vulnerable to the virus, such as, you know, people in the senior living facilities and so on. So they're still declaring a qualified victory. But, you know, as we see from, you know, two different types of media, you see the conservative media, they still hold DeSantis up as example of virus response. The liberal media, he's a punching bag, he's a joke.
But that point you make about long-term care facilities, nursing homes, that was a point that the governor did hammer on time and time again. Even as he was pushing for businesses to be able to reopen, he was prohibiting local governments from fining people for breaking local mask mandates. He would point to long-term care facilities as the point priority, and that carried through even into December as we started to hope for vaccines, where the governor was putting long-term care patients ahead of healthcare frontline workers in terms of vaccinations.
Right. And that comes down to risk factor in terms of, you know, casualty rate. You know, somebody, the older you are, the sicker you are, the more comorbidities you have, the more likely you are to have serious consequences or die from this virus. And, you know, the governor's made that case in press conference over and over again across the state. But at the same time, I mean, his messaging for people who are not of retirement age, who are not in those last months and years of life, has been a little bit different. It's been basically like, we will gut our way through it. We saw how the governor brought Scott Atlas, the disgraced Donald Trump COVID task force member, to Florida for three different stops a couple of months ago, basically to validate the governor's strategy. It's a very politicized, Fox News-friendly response. It allows this governor, who's cut his teeth in the House Freedom Caucus and then on the Republican right, to basically rehearse talking points. And with this administration, you're always going to see policy and politics walking hand in hand.
And Ana Ceballos, what about that? Obviously, Ron DeSantis has higher political aspirations. He's widely expected to try to make a run for president in 4 years. The politics of his pandemic response in 2020 will certainly be part of his public record as he seeks any other office. He seemed to make a bet that it would play with voters in Florida, that the majority of Florida voters this year would back him up, would support his approach to governing in a pandemic. The president did win the state of Florida in 2020, although, of course, he lost the election overall. So how do you assess the political calculus the governor has made when it comes to his approach to combating COVID-19 in this state?
Right. And I think that's a really good point. We know that Governor Ron DeSantis is an ambitious politician. We know that he's expressed interest in a potential run for the White House. And I think what we saw in 2020 was a pretty strategic. He's a very smart guy. He is a strategic and ambitious take on how a response that mirrored what the Trump administration had been pushing would be handled here in Florida as the president was running for re-election. So when you saw the like what AG was saying regarding Scott Atlas, you know, that was a panel conversation that had to do with most of the points that President Donald Trump was trying to make throughout the pandemic. So yeah.
Let's be clear, Scott Atlas, hugely controversial figure in the world of public health.
Correct.
Yeah.
But DeSantis gave someone like Atlas a pretty big platform in his state here in terms of what policy would be rolled out here in the state. And when we started seeing the mirroring of what President Donald Trump wanted and how DeSantis was acting, we started seeing a very wide third phrase. The reopening phase was pretty wide. You know, that there was, at first, it was about giving local governments some leeway with how they would want to handle the situation locally, because they would be the ones who would know best. And all of a sudden, as there's more pressure coming from the White House, we see even like local ordinances go out. Right. They can have the ordinances, but they have no more teeth because they can't fine people who violate those local rules. And the reopening of the schools was another big political move. Donald Trump was pretty adamant about reopening schools and how that needed to happen. And we saw that almost, it was a pattern that, as the president said it, the state followed suit, and it has continued to this day.
There continues to be a real lockstep between the Trump administration and the DeSantis administration in terms of the response to the pandemic. I suppose during the 2020 election cycle, the one place where there was some daylight between the two was on vote by mail, right? The president used the bully pulpit pretty continuously, even after the election, to demonize, really, vote-by-mail ballots. And you did not necessarily hear Governor DeSantis pick up that same line as it comes to voting by mail in Florida. And in fact, the president eased his language just ever so slightly, AG, when it came to vote-by-mail in Florida, a place where he himself is registered to vote.
Florida's got a different system in a lot of states where the controversies have come in. Those ballots are counted as they come in. You know, that's how, as the governor's pointed out, and as the president's pointed out, we had our results early on election night. We didn't have these multi-day narratives that lend themselves sort of the fever swamp speculation on the right about these elections in other states. And, you know, so it's two different types of systems. And, you know, Senator Rick Scott and others have reforms that would make Florida voting more of a model for the rest of the country, and we'll see if those get through or not. But there is a little bit of nuance in the vote-by-mail argument, and the president developed it. He discovered it, but a little bit too late. I mean, you saw in state after state how Republicans did not perform in terms of vote-by-mail, regardless of the efforts of state parties like the ones in Florida to drive it. Here in Florida, they kind of stopped the bleeding a little bit, and that's because of Chair of State Joe Gruters and others who, you know, really pushed the message. But in other states where the state party wasn't as strong, the messaging got wobbly, and that hurt the president.
Hmm. Well, then let me ask both of you this question, since you cover Florida politics so closely. We've been known for so many years as a swing state. Is that still the case after this election? Anna, could I start with you?
Sure. I mean, I think there's the argument has been made that we're more of a battleground state than a swing state, considering how the election went this year. I don't know how AG feels about that in terms of how he views it. But it was mainly due to the stats that we saw, right? I mean, we've always talked about nationally how Florida, it's about Florida, Florida, Florida. I think the last time a president won the White House was in 1992, and it was without Florida. So winning the presidential race without Florida has been a very difficult thing. And Florida has always won by razor thin margins. We saw that in 2016 when Trump won by 1.2%. And then he nearly tripled that this year. And so when it was supposed to be the tightest of races and the most, you know, polarized elections cycle, and all this information about vote by mail, and all of a sudden we see these margins, I think there is the argument to be made that maybe we're no longer, we are a battleground state. We will always be competitive, but maybe we're not the swing state that we were.
That we were. AG.
Yeah, I disagree with her a little bit because I think Florida is kind of singular, and I think the Trump relationship with Florida was kind of singular. I think Trump and Trumpism outperformed here in other places, but I don't know if Trumpism and Trump are going to be issues in the 2024 ballot the same way. It's got a lot of time ahead before that election really firms up. I think Florida is definitely a swing state. Demographics, I think, are going to tend more Democratic over the election cycles. We will not see it in legislative apportionment for this next decade because it's a Republican legislature and it's going to be a Republican-looking map, especially in the state house level. But, you know, in terms of the state being a jump ball in 2022 when DeSantis is running for re-election 2024 and going forward, it's a jump ball until further notice, despite the president's good margin in the state last month.
But we,
I'm sorry, in November.
In November, yeah. But we did see gains from national Republicans. We saw two congressional seats, Anna, here in South Florida, flip from Democrats to Republicans, which helps turn South Florida, particularly Dade County, at least on the national scale, a deeper red.
Right. I mean, Republicans really did make gains across the nation. And in Florida specifically, we saw, you know, Democrats lose five House in the Florida House, one seat in the Florida Senate, two congressional seats. A lot of it came from Miami-Dade, if someone described it as a bloodbath for Democrats, considering, you know, the huge gains that Trump made in that one specific county that is considered a pretty big Democratic stronghold. So when you see those gains, it does raise questions as to how is the Republican Party and the Democratic Party how are they making gains and who are they appealing to? I think Susie Wiles, who ran Trump's reelection campaign here, she described as the Republican Party is now one big tent. They made a lot of gains with the Hispanic vote and not just Cuban Americans in Miami-Dade. They also made gains with Puerto Ricans in Osceola County. And the appeal to a wider range of demographics within the Republican Party does raise a question as to what will happen in other competitive statewide races here in the state. Will that resonate for other races? You know, beyond governor, the 2022 cycle will include a Senate race right. on all three Florida cabinet posts will be on the ballot as well. That will be an interesting time to really see whether it was a 2020 thing that happened and with yeah. Trump and how big of a win he had this year, or if it actually resonated and the gains that the Republicans made here in the state will be translating to potential larger wins for other statewide races here in the state. And
AG, I just want to,
the ones I just mentioned.
I just want to hear from you in 20 seconds before we have to break, but it's the NPA voter that's on that swing piece here that the parties are really fighting over.
Yeah, it's always the MPAs, but the paradox of MPAs is they're not heavy turnout people. So you have to have the right candidate or the right message. That's not always a given.
That's A.G. Gankarski. He's a reporter with Florida Politics. He's going to stick around, as is Ana Ceballos. She covers state government and politics for the Miami Herald.
More political talk as we capture the year that was and look ahead to 2021. Keep listening. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio on this New Year's Day. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this New Year's Day. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. In just a few weeks, the presidential political ground will shift significantly for Florida. Instead of a friendly partisan relationship between Tallahassee and the White House, Governor Ron DeSantis and President-elect Joe Biden will be on separate sides of the political divide. You know, the pandemic, health care, the environment, just a few of the issues here in Florida that can be shaped by connections between the governor's mansion in the Sunshine State and the Oval Office in Washington, D.C.
That's right. So we're continuing our political discussion with two experts who study Florida politics all the time, Ana Ceballos, covering state government and politics for the Miami Herald, and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. A.G., let's kick this off with you. Obviously, Governor Ron DeSantis was banking on President Trump winning another 4 years. That didn't happen. So how will this administration pivot to dealing with a Biden administration? And what does that portend for the state of Florida?
It's going to be a very adversarial relationship, in large part on purpose. And there's precedent for it. I mean, when Rick Scott was governor, Barack Obama was president, Rick Scott would often grouse when things weren't going his way. I need a partner in the White House. Rick Scott got that partner, but not everything turned around. With DeSantis, he's had a kind of a charmed life in the Trump era. But with Biden, you can expect a lot more legal challenges for executive orders and things like that. Expect Attorney General Ashley Moody to be more activist in terms of, you know, challenging things that may come from Washington, especially in the early days of the Biden administration. I'm expecting President-elect Biden to showcase Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. Fried has been on the outs with DeSantis for the last year or so. The leading Democrat in the state, early Biden supporter. So you're going to see that kind of showcase, and that kind of set up for 2022. But
because she obviously is expected to run against DeSantis for governor, and that
right.
that will help her.
She would get a lot of resistance running for ag commissioner again. And I think she has higher sights.
Ana, I'm wondering, particularly when it comes to the environment, that was an issue where Governor DeSantis, early in his gubernatorial term, surprised a lot of people, particularly compared to how Governor Rick Scott dealt with the environment. And DeSantis really leveraged that close relationship that he had with President Trump to loosen up the federal purse strings when it comes to Everglades restoration and other big environmental projects that really rest on the tens of billions of dollars that need to flow from the federal government and did flow for the first time in many, many years. So how does that particular issue then get shaped by the different kind of relationship between Governor DeSantis and President-elect Biden?
Yeah, and that's a really good point. And I think there has even been a public joke that Trump would say at his campaign rallies here that, you know, that the governor only called him to ask for money and that he would always say yes. And so it will be really interesting to see this new dynamic with, like AG said, with between DeSantis, an ambitious Republican governor who is potentially eyeing a run for the White House, with a Democratic president who, it will be likely on purpose to be combative at times, to just draw the line of what his agenda is. And it will be interesting to see how he navigates that relationship with President Biden in terms of funding for key environmental projects. We saw when he first came into office in January 2019, I forgot what year it was, in January 2019, how he did lay out a pretty grand, really, environmental package that included new positions in his administration to look at climate change and more funding for water resources and cleaning up like all these the springs and just environmental proposals that would be appealing to Democrats, Republicans, moderates, and it was interesting to see that slowly kind of go away.
That really did. Like, he really did start, you know, Tom and everybody, he started out in such a centrist fashion, and that really did fall by the wayside as his first term progressed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And right. So it'll be interesting to see if he takes it back up and see how he will be using that specific platform with the Biden administration.
And there may be some harmony, AG, with the Biden administration on this, right? I mean, Governor DeSantis is the governor who said climate change, who said sea level rise. And now you've got President-elect Biden in the form of former Secretary of State John Kerry having the first climate czar. So there may be some harmony, or is that just optimistic and not having a firm grasp of the political reality over the next 2 to 4 years?
Tom, I appreciate your optimism, but I do not see Governor DeSantis letting President-elect Biden score any victories in the state if he can help it. Yeah. He is going to stress contrast in messaging. He's going to emerge as a high-profile nationwide challenger of things that the Biden administration does. He's going to have a lot of backup from the legislative branch. So that's really going to be to play. Any environmental progress that happens in the state and federally will probably happen independently of each other in terms of messaging.
We're speaking with Ana Ceballos of the Miami Herald and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics about Florida politics, the year that was and the year ahead. Okay, let's talk about the fact that former President Trump, soon to be former President Trump, is expected to set up residence at Mar-a-Lago in South Florida. We've heard that his daughter, Ivanka Trump, and her husband, Jared Kushner, are eyeing property in South Florida as well. That she may even seek political office running from Florida. So how does the Trump factor complicate politics in the state, Ana, as we look ahead to 2021, particularly since, as we know, Ron DeSantis hasn't really made a secret out of the fact that he'd like to run for president himself?
Right. And I guess one thing to consider, when the 2020 election cycle ended, that immediately started the jockeying for the 2024 presidential runs, and 2020 election cycle also has already begun. And I think it will be interesting to see how Trump has a role in that dynamic in Florida politics, because DeSantis remains a huge Trump ally, whether he won or lost the election. And he lost the election, but you know what I mean? He's still a huge ally of Trump. And as he considers a run for the White House, if he does, he will need to remain close to that platform. And now that he has delivered the state in 2020, when he delivered the state to Trump, I think that helped DeSantis in terms of his own platform. He did not let Trump down in terms of delivering Florida to him. And it will be interesting to see how involved Trump becomes with local politics in a way. I don't know if he's going to continue doing rallies throughout the country and become a vocal Palm Beach resident here.
Is he going to be interesting to watch. And is he going to set up, as has been speculated on, AG, a media concern that he might try to run out of Florida, like a streaming video, an online Trump TV? Is that something that we should anticipate happening here in this state?
Yeah, word was he was eyeing Newsmax. He's talked fondly about One America News Network and these type operations. They are about three steps below real cable news in terms of production values, talent working for them, et cetera. So anything that Trump acquired would have to come with a real upgrade of talent. I have to speak to this idea of the president becoming a big political force in state politics for the next 4 years. I don't know how much patience he's going to have with state-level politics in terms of playing around with, like, the Florida Republican Party or whatever. He will probably weigh into the chair's race and things like that. But there's been some wild speculation. My favorite one is Ivanka Trump running for governor of the state of Florida in 2026. That's hilarious. Imagine her and Jared Kushner tooling around Tallahassee.
You don't see that?
With five restaurants to go to and trying to work
out. Hey, now, I hear Clyde's is great. No, I don't know what you mean. It's a swinging place. No?
I mean, but that's the thing, though. Being governor, it's a grunt job, and that's why this current governor doesn't seem that interested in it. Can you imagine Ivanka and Jared trying to work out something about a tax package or about Airbnbs, trying to resolve the difference between the Senate and the House versions of bills? They would run away screaming. And that's the paradox of all of this. The Trumps can come down here and dominate, but why would they want to? It's small potatoes compared to what they're leaving in the White House. So this can be a launch pad, but I don't see them wading waist deep into the muck of Florida politics there's no there, as Gertrude Stein.
I think one of the other political
point where it's maybe they don't run for office per se, but what they say politically will influence how politicians act here in the state. So he still has a base. He still has a lot of supporters that we've seen, as we have seen at his rallies. And it'll be really interesting to see, really, if his political clout still carries weight when others are trying to run for office, and whether they're going to have to shape their talking points, messaging, agenda based on what Trump keeps telling his supporters.
Yeah, how they
in the political world.
Yeah, how they conform their messaging to other parts of Florida in order to get the king and queen maker that the Trumps may become as Florida residents. And one other piece of political paradox here is if the addresses of both President Trump and his daughter and son-in-law are true, they will be represented in Congress by Democratic members of Florida's congressional district.
Yeah, they're not moving to a red county anytime soon. They like the nightlife. That's not in red Florida.
They like to book. I'm going to date myself, but you just reminded me of a song from the 70s that I won't say the whole line.
Stay at the YMCA.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, you know, we can speculate about all this, but one thing I think the last year has shown is that it's probably folly to speculate too much, because who the heck knows what's going to happen? I think that we probably can't even begin to anticipate, Tom. It's just been extraordinary.
It truly has. And also, you know, we've talked about the influence in the Republican Party. Let's not kid ourselves here, right, Anna? I mean, what the Trumps have done is they've influenced the Democratic Party here in Florida, and we will likely see a response over the next several years about how the Florida Democratic Party organizes itself and runs campaigns.
Exactly. I mean, I think the margins by which Trump won Florida has really been it was an atomic bomb over the Florida Democratic Party. You know, the chairman, Terry Rizzo, has already said she's not running after, you know, losing pretty key Senate, House, and seats and here in the legislature. And there are already people running to replace her, and it will be really a reckoning as to what where the party goes next. And there's already a lot of intra-party fights and tension and all these public feuds, really, about what Democrats believe the party should be doing. And so, you know, we're seeing running to replace Rizzo is a former Miami Mayor Manny Diaz. There's a DNC member named Nikki Barnes. There's Alachua County Democratic Chair and former Rep. Cynthia Chestnut, Janelle Chris. There's a lot of people running to lead the party and to make things a little bit better for Democrats than things went in 2020.
Yeah.
For the next election cycle.
Anna, let me
it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
It will be. Anna Ceballos with us. Stick with us. A.G. Gankarski, and you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
On this New Year's Day, we're taking a look back at 2020 and a look ahead at the year to come. And of course, AG, the big thing we will all be watching is the rollout of the coronavirus vaccine to hospitals around the state. This is going to be a big logistical challenge for the governor and health agencies, and they are going to have to work closely with the White House to make this work, to get people vaccinated. What are you hearing about this whole process? What do you foresee there?
Well, I think the thing you've got to watch is the handoff in Washington between the Trump and the Biden administrations. The Trump administration has put a lot of the onus on governors, with the president saying they're going to have to work hard and things like that. They're vague. They're not really policy directives. But they're kind of indications of the fact that governors are really going to have to organize this process. Luckily, Florida's got, you know, a good division of emergency management. They know how to do this. But I think really the handoff with the Biden administration, and I'm watching that specifically because you do have a Democrat heading the head of emergency management. That's Jared Moskowitz. And he'll probably be the liaison with the Biden administration, and maybe they can get something going there in terms of the vaccines going out. But the safety net hospitals will see them first. You know, senior facilities and so on, and they'll go from there. And I think, as the saying goes, pack your patience. It's going to take a while.
Anna, is there a potential, though, for more friction? Because a CDC panel recommended that healthcare workers be the first to get vaccines. And the governor, in the month of December, talked about how his priority were patients at nursing home, long-term care facilities. In fact, promised that long-term care facility patients would all be vaccinated with the first round before the end of December.
Right. And I think that there could be the potential for friction. Like you said, DeSantis said that the state's proposal will be calling for the vaccination of seniors in nursing homes before the end of December, and that he also wanted to get vaccines and prioritize like the high contact frontline healthcare workers in certain urban areas by the end of, to get them in line as a priority as well. So it does raise questions, you know, whether it's seniors, is it the frontline workers, the people who are most at risk? It will be, I mean, in terms of the draft plan that we know the state has proposed, there's not been that many details other than numbers and how quickly the vaccines will be distributed, and communication will be important as to how this will be distributed, who will be prioritized, but there could be friction in terms of seniors versus frontline workers.
Yeah, and AG, when it comes to healthcare overall, of course, Florida is part of the healthcare.gov Affordable Care Act. And, you know, the Biden administration is pretty intent on that, as well as a number of other healthcare spending measures from the federal government. We've only got just a couple of seconds before our mix here, before our break. But how do we look at healthcare with this relationship between the new president and Governor DeSantis?
I expect any legal challenge to anything that basically crowds forward his prerogatives in that realm. It's something where Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, these are philosophical issues for Republicans, and
yeah,
I don't see the Sands budget.
And more to come on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We will be right back. Don't go away.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio, and Happy New Year. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, as we continue our look ahead to 2021, first let's take a look back. Florida is one of the few states in the nation that did not hold a special legislative session in 2020 in response to the pandemic. So when lawmakers convene in early March in Tallahassee, it will actually be the first time they've met in a law writing session since COVID-19 shut down tourism across the state and blew a big hole in state revenues. We're continuing the discussion right now.
Anna Ceballos is the state government politics reporter for the Miami Herald with us from Tallahassee. A.G. Gankarski covers statewide politics for Florida Politics. Anna, why no special session earlier during this pandemic?
So that was one of the big things that Democrats were trying to push in mid 2020. They said that they wanted to hold a special session to start addressing some of like the unemployment issues that they were seeing at the time when the unemployment site crashed, and there was a lot of unemployment throughout the state and with people lacking really the funds because of closures. There was none, and now, you know, that the election's over, that they're resuming business, we are seeing Senate and the House impaneled really a pandemic committee that will be looking at how to handle pandemics in the future. They said Senate President Wilton Simpson has specifically said that the part of the role of those committees will be to review the executive orders issued by the governor, whether it was evictions, whether it was just the emergency powers that went on with gutting certain local ordinances with mask mandates. It will be a wide-ranging review of the Republican governor's executive orders and emergency orders during the pandemic. What they will find will be an interesting political question as to, you know, will Republicans push back? Will they praise them? Will they raise questions about certain things? Will they say next time there's a pandemic? Hopefully they won't be. Should these be the protocols that should be followed? Or, I mean, it's all up on the table right now.
All on the table. Well, AG, what can we expect them to do about all of these sort of kitchen table issues that are making life miserable for hundreds of thousands of people around the state? People worried about being evicted, people that can't get unemployment benefits through the state's system. It's been a mess all year. Can we expect the Florida legislature to address some of these economic problems for people?
In theory, yes. I think there's a lot of hope that federal care package will help ameliorate some of the pain. But the advice that, you know, Senate President Walton Simpson's giving Speaker Chris Browse is tighten your belts. It's going to be a tight budget in terms of, you know, social programs and things like that. And that's really going to be the way forward for the state. It's going to be that kind of rugged individualism because reserves are sapped. You know, the state had healthy reserve levels going into the pandemic. They're not there now. You know, there's only going to be so much economic recovery until the larger national economy recovers because we're so tourism dependent. So these issues that make Florida such an attractive boom time economy really can slow down the recovery. So it's going to be kind of a grim session, and it's going to be a lot of austerity.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, that their revenues are sapped, so they don't really have a lot of places to go to find more money, do they?
Right. I mean, the reserves are sapped. The revenues are recovering, but, you know, the fact that we spent so heavily in reserves the last, 9 months of last year, you know, that puts the state in a tenuous position. You know, this is the rainy day.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, to tap into that rainy day fund. So, Anna, what are the options? You know, the state budget that is funded by state-based revenues, so much of it goes to healthcare and public education. So what are the options that state lawmakers have for either finding new revenue or looking to tighten the belt?
Right. So right now, I believe the latest estimates were that they were looking at about a $5 billion budget hole over the next 2 years. And it's a task that will be that was central to the speeches that both Senate President Wilson Simpson and House Speaker Chris Bowles gave when they reorganized session in November. And some of the things that were floated as proposals for budget cuts would be potentially, or for finding money, would be raising tuition for mm-hmm. state universities. That hasn't happened in a while. And there's been some pushback, including from former Governor Rick Scott. So that's one potential avenue. But really, I mean, that would not be enough. They would need to again, they keep saying that, or Simpson was saying that he wanted to cut programs that have not been in use. He didn't really specify what specific programs, so that will be part of the debate. Education is a huge part of the budget. Healthcare is also a huge part of the budget. So it remains to be seen, but right now both the House and the Senate have said that they're considering tuition hikes potentially.
Interesting. We're speaking with Anna Ceballos of the Miami Herald and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics on this first ever Florida Roundup on New Year's Day for the new year as we take a look ahead to politics and news in Florida for the coming year. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
A.G., do lawmakers have an appetite to look for new revenue, not higher taxes of current existing taxes? We know that generally is off the table, but I'm thinking of like sports betting, something that's floated around Tallahassee for a good long time. Medical marijuana, certainly, which is throughout the state now and a potential source of additional revenue.
Well, there hasn't been a sports betting bill yet. I don't know about that. There is appetite for adult use cannabis. You know, the medical program that exists now has got pushing 450,000 people. That product's not taxable. So where the state makes its money is in licenses, mm-hmm. user licenses, and licenses of the cannabis companies themselves. Governor DeSantis does not want recreational marijuana, as they call it. There is some appetite for it, but I don't see it coming to the floor this session or next. That's why, again, when I look at the options in front of the state, you're going to see cuts in this budget, and that's going to be the narrative, because there's simply not that magic bullet there, like a legalized cannabis without a proponent who has real control in the House, Senate, or governor's mansion making that case.
Anna, let me ask you one more question in the time we have left. We talked about this earlier in the hour. The big rolling story throughout the year will be the vaccine, getting it distributed, making sure the most vulnerable people get it first, and then the rest of us. What else can you share with us about what you're hearing about the logistics of how that's going to be handled for this state?
Right. So I believe the Florida draft plan for the vaccine that we obtained, I believe it was in early November, it pretty much said that about 3.5 million Floridians, which would be mostly healthcare providers or medically vulnerable or first responders, would be giving priority status when the first doses would be arriving in the state. Right now, I guess there's still questions as to when exactly those doses will be coming in. But DeSantis did say that, there is a goal of vaccinating seniors in nursing homes before the end of December.
And, and this whole thing about the Pfizer five, the five hospitals that have been tapped around the state to store the vaccine. We've heard, AG, that drugstores like Walgreens and CVS could be part of the rollout. This is just something that we're going to be watching closely through the year.
Yeah, I mean, we'll be watching the deployment of vaccine, the potential side effects of vaccines, how vaccines are sold to the American public and also the public in this state, because there already is a House bill, basically an anti-vax bill that would remove state authority to order vaccinations. That's from Anthony Sabatini. So you're going to see a robust dialogue, not just about how to get the vaccine out to people, but whether people should vaccinate or not. And I wouldn't discount that in this state.
Anna, how do you think that shapes the public perception in Florida of a vaccination program in the year ahead?
Right. I think, like AG said, it's a key element to having an efficient vaccine distribution plan in the state will have to be confidence in the vaccine. And I have heard, in addition to that specific bill that Representative Anthony Sabatini filed, to remove the state's authority to vaccinate certain people if there's an emergency public need. There has been talk from certain Republicans in the Senate that, emphasizing that they are not going to mandate vaccines, that it still remains an option. And I've seen some messaging regarding that, like more about the option to be vaccinated rather than building confidence in the vaccine in certain cases.
Anna, we
so it'll be interesting to see what the messaging is statewide regarding confidence in what medical experts have deemed to be a safe vaccine and side effects and just more knowledge about how that will work.
Anna, we got to leave it there. Anna Ceballos, Miami Herald state government reporter with the Miami Herald, and A.G. Gankarski with Florida Politics. Thanks, folks.
And thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup on this New Year's Day. It comes to you from WJCT in Jacksonville and WLRN in Miami. I'm Melissa Ross, and Happy New Year, Tom.
Happy New Year, Melissa. Theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Have a great New Year. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio.